nothing like what Juno has ever done here has happened before. There is no prior case like this.
A lawsuit over a Juno head tax on cruise ship passengers goes to court. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, September 18. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, researchers are studying odd bubbles popping up at a Fairbanks golf course.
To see and to hear about methane bubbles under grass in a golf course lawn is very different.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. And by Strong Hearts Native Helpline, offering peer-to-peer support and resources for Native Americans affected by domestic violence. Safe, confidential, and toll-free, 1-844-7-NATIVE. This message is sponsored by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
A lawsuit brought by the cruise industry challenging the city and borough of Juneau's head tax on cruise passengers is headed for trial. As Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports, attorneys argued early today over whether passenger fees are constitutional.
The cruise industry's lawsuit alleges the $8 in fees levied on passengers violates the U.S. Constitution's tonnage clause, which prohibits states from taxing vessels in port. The plaintiffs told the judge the framers considered safeguarding interstate commerce as important as preventing a state from minting its own currency or declaring war. Those powers are for the feds and the feds alone. The city attorneys countered that James Madison couldn't have conceived of vessels bringing more than 10,000 daily visitors into a community of 30,000 people. Judge H. Russell Holland asked pointed questions. At times, he seemed skeptical about the cruise industry's argument that services paid with marine passenger fees had to be directly tied to ship operations. He pointed to public bathrooms as an example, saying, quote, outhouses far from the docks but heavily used by cruise passengers still need to be cleaned. Speaking outside the courtroom, Washington, D.C. cruise industry attorney Jonathan Benner said the city's fees aren't legal because they're not for goods or services like selling fuel or hauling waste.
These are not user fees as such. If they were and they were particularized and they were compensatory, you wouldn't have an argument. What it is it's a revenue stream that the city has created, and then it's redispensing it as it sees fit. And we believe that just blows a big hole in the Constitution.
The city's defense is that every item spent can be reasonably tied back to benefiting cruise ship passengers, from longer cruise docks for the bigger ships to seasonal crossing guards that control downtown traffic. City Attorney Rob Palmer defended the city's record.
We believe that we have collected fees that are reasonable, and we believe that we're spending the fees in a constitutional way for the betterment of the community and the cruise ship industry and their passengers. And so this case is a really big deal for the city, and we're doing our best to make sure that we have a community that works.
Cruise industry lawyers told the judge they aren't seeking repayment. They just want the city's power to levy fees eliminated. The city countered it wouldn't make sense to refund fees to the industry anyway, since they never paid a penny. It's the cruise passengers that fork over the $8 as part of their booking. The judge has several motions and countermotions to rule on before the case moves to trial. In the meantime, both sides are asking for a quick resolution through summary judgment. There's also interest in this case outside Juneau. That's because the precedent it could set. Benner said attorneys are in uncharted waters.
Nothing like what Juneau has ever done here has happened before. There is no prior case like this.
It's been a costly fight. The city spent $776,000 on legal defense since a lawsuit was filed in 2016. At stake is about $10 million in annual revenue to the city. The outcome could also affect the state of Alaska's own passenger fee. Last year, the state collected $18.5 million. It shared all but $2.5 million with port communities. The judge remarked from the bench the case is not a simple matter and indicated it would be some time before he would rule. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Golfers at a course in Fairbanks regularly encounter methane bubbles. People poke them with tees and light them on fire. Those bubbles recently piqued the interest of a researcher who usually looks for methane bubbles in lakes and wetlands. She says methane formation on land could be a new frontier for science. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Ravenna Koenig has the story.
In many respects, the North Star Golf Club looks like any other golf course. Emerald grass dotted with ponds, idyllic forest on all sides, a flock of bothersome geese. But it's full of dips and swells, like a pond frozen mid-ripple. That's not by design, according to Roger Evans, the owner.
25 years ago, this was all a disced field that was all smooth.
Really?
So this is all permafrost action.
Evans is out on his golf course this morning in big boots, squelching through the waterlogged grass to help scientist Katie Walter Anthony and her two assistants find some methane bubbles. Walter Anthony has been studying methane bubbles in Alaska and Russia for almost 20 years. She says that the reason methane is being produced beneath this turf likely has to do with the permafrost thaw Evans described. That thaw triggers the breakdown of organic matter that has accumulated beneath the soil over thousands of years.
It's like opening the freezer door, making it accessible to microbes that decompose it and turn it from organic carbon in the soil organic matter back into greenhouse gases.
Often the greenhouse gas released is carbon dioxide. But when the decomposition happens in an environment without a lot of oxygen, it can produce methane too. The most obvious place for scientists to look for that kind of methane is in lakes and wetlands, because standing water makes it hard for oxygen to get into the soil. That's where Walter Anthony usually does her research.
To see and to hear about methane bubbles under grass in a golf course lawn is very different than the type of environment we're normally sampling methane in.
This golf course is not exactly a wetland, but after 4 inches of rain in August, it is pretty soggy. And Evan says that the methane bubbles usually appear during the wet seasons, spring and fall. Walter Anthony thinks rainwater may be pooling above a layer of impermeable permafrost, creating the conditions for methane production. After about 20 minutes of searching, we finally find what we're looking for.
Oh, here's one.
Oh! Ah! Okay. Great.
The bubble is sort of flat. Not like the bigger ones that Evans has described as beach balls that bulge up out of the ground. But when you tap the ground with your foot, you can definitely tell that it's not normal grass. It wobbles like jello, or as Walter Anthony's colleague, Philip Honka, puts it.
It's kind of like an air mattress.
Or a waterbed.
Using a syringe and a sawed-off plastic bottle, Walter Anthony collects several vials of methane gas.
And pull, and that should...
Beautiful. Cool.
She'll use those samples to confirm that the methane really does come from thawed organic matter in the permafrost. She's pretty sure it does, based on the obvious permafrost thaw all around us. But why is the methane forming bubbles? Walter Anthony cuts up a square of the soil.
Well, probably this is probably that little silt layer right there. I know.
Walter Anthony hypothesizes that the density and fineness of the silt, combined with the layer of grass, could make it hard for the methane to escape. All the traffic the golf course gets could be part of it too, compressing the top layer to make it even more dense. That's all interesting to Walter Anthony, but what she's really curious about is if this phenomenon is happening elsewhere on land.
It's an area that I and some other colleagues have started thinking about. Can you get methane forming in terrestrial environments? But it's a very new area of science.
It's a new area of science because grasslands and boreal forests are thought of as places where greenhouse gases are absorbed, not released. But as permafrost thaw increases in the interior, releasing more trapped carbon, Walter Anthony wonders if that's changing. That would be really important for scientists to document and build into climate models, since potential emissions from the ground could contribute to global warming. Walter Anthony says that none of this is definitive yet, but that's why it merits further study. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Ravenna Koenig in Fairbanks.
Juneau's Diamond Courthouse won't be adding another security officer as a result of a recent alleged assault in the courtroom. But the Alaska State Troopers say they'll guarantee that there is an officer or trooper in any courtroom where they're requested. On August 6th, 26-year-old Tyler Letham allegedly attacked his grandmother, Connie Chitty. It occurred during a hearing over whether the state would become Letham's guardian. Chitty says Lethem has been diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia and had just been released from jail after another alleged assault against her in February. It took 11 minutes for an officer to arrive. Lieutenant John Brown is the deputy commander for the trooper's attachment in Ketchikan. He says the incident may make parties, lawyers, and judges more likely to request an officer.
Hopefully, they're able to look at that information prior to going to the hearing and say, you know, this person has displayed aggressive behavior in the past, and maybe we should have some type of security here at the courtroom when this hearing happens.
Brown noted that officers are automatically assigned to hearings with prisoners. While the courthouse had three officers in the past, Brown says one of the officers' positions was converted into a trooper position. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, three Alaska tribal organizations received nearly $3 million in federal housing grants.
It's not just going in and repairing homes, it's educating people about managing their homes in a healthy manner.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Bethel Search and Rescue is scaling back its search efforts for a missing man who is possibly related to a recent boat accident. The group is waiting for Alaska State Troopers to gather more information on the case. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
28-year-old Stacy Hoagland of Akiak was reported missing last Thursday. That same day, the body of 25-year-old Holly Maeda was found floating in a slough below Napakiak. The events are suspected to be connected. Bethel Search and Rescue says before they disappeared, both Hoagland and Maeda are reported to have been at the same party at a fish camp on Strait Slough, upriver from Bethel. Troopers found a boat submerged near the island across from Bethel the day after Maeda's body was discovered. The three clues, Maeda's body, the fish camp, and the boat, are all within a 20-mile range, a large area. False rumors circulated that troopers told search and rescue groups to stand down. Instead, Bethel Search and Rescue Vice President Perry Barr says what happened is that the Bethel group decided to rein in its search until more information became available. The troopers are investigating the incidents, and Search and Rescue hopes to use any information gathered to narrow its search. The members want to give Hoagland's family the peace and closure that recovering his body would bring. This afternoon, at least six boats, half from Bethel and half from Kasigluk, were looking for the missing Hoagland. The volunteers roamed the water and land around the slough where Holly Maeda's body had been found. Bethel Search and Rescue Canine, DOG, is with them. Some Bethel members stayed up late Monday night, relearning how to operate the group's underwater camera so they'd be prepared to take it out today. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
The Chilista Regional Native Corporation has denied any wrongdoing in an ongoing sexual harassment lawsuit against the company. KYUK's Teresa Katsarilis has more.
In a jointly filed response last Friday, Chilista CEO Andrew Guy claims that he and his corporation didn't do anything wrong. When a woman approached Guy with a sexual harassment complaint against a Chilista top executive, his attorneys argue that he dealt with it appropriately. Their filing denies that Guy tried to bury her claim, and it denies that the Chilista corporation put the woman in harm's way. The woman, of course, tells a different story. Tiffany Phillips accuses former executive George Alatuck of relentlessly harassing her when she tried to sell her company to Chilista. She says Alatuck sent her Victoria's Secret lingerie, a handwritten love letter, and over 1,000 text messages, none of which Chilista disputes. When Phillips told CEO Andrew Guy about the harassment, she claims he tried to bury it by failing to report her complaint to Chilista's Human Resources Department. And she also claims that Chilista should have known Alatuck posed a threat to her. According to a memo written by former Human Resources Director Heather Speer, Chilista had already disciplined Alatuck for harassing his co-workers several times before. Phillips is suing Andrew Guy for breach of contract and the Calista Corporation for negligence. In their initial complaint, her attorneys also sued Alituk for sexual harassment, but he has since been dismissed from the case. Earlier this year, Alituk left both his family and the country and is believed to be living in Ecuador. Phillips' legal team was unable to find him and serve him with the proper paperwork. Guy's critics accuse him of burying Phillips' harassment complaint to protect Alituk. The two men have known each other since college and have gone hunting and traveling together. Guy is also the godfather of one of Alituk's daughters. In the response filed Friday, Guy's attorneys made an effort to distance him from Alituk. The filing states that he, quote, sporadically kept in touch with Alituk, and that Andrew Guy and his wife have been godparents to a great many children. The lawsuit has been moved to federal court, and the court has set a scheduling conference for November 28th. It is one of two lawsuits that Calista is currently involved in. The corporation is also trying to forcibly remove its former chairman, Colonel Wayne Dawn, from its board of directors. Dawn raised concerns about Guy's treatment of Phillips last year, and Guy's allies claim he was trying to use the controversy as leverage in a failed boardroom coup. In Bethel, I'm Teresa Katsourilis.
The former treasurer for an Anchorage Youth Hockey Association has been sentenced to 14 months in federal prison for embezzlement. 34-year-old Jennifer Sue Chan, also known as Jennifer Kerr, was sentenced for embezzling more than $150,000 from the Mustang Hockey Association in the Eagle River area. Sue Chan had pleaded guilty to three counts of wire fraud. She agreed to pay more than $170,000 in restitution. Sue Chan in 2015 began forging the signature of another board member and wrote checks to herself. She falsely claimed the money was spent on association expenses. Prosecutors say she spent the money on family trips, car and mortgage payments, and a $1,500 chicken coop. Prosecutors say she forged more than 140 checks over 2.5 years and withdrew $14,000 in association cash. Golden Valley Electric Association's chief executive says the 50-megawatt Healy 2 power plant is finally online and commercially operational. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Golden Valley President and CEO Corey Borgeson said Thursday he expected Healy 2 to reach an important requirement overnight that'll qualify the coal-fired power plant to be declared commercially operational.
As of midnight tonight, GVA's Healy Unit 2 will have reached the milestone set by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska.
The RCA, which regulates the state's utilities, required Healy 2 to operate for at least 30 days at 85% or higher availability. The availability factor of a power plant is based on the amount of time it's able to generate electricity dependably over a given period of time.
The RCA wanted us to meet at least 85% availability for the 30-day period, so we far exceeded that.
Golden Valley workers and contractors have been slowly stepping up operation of Healy 2 since July, after they'd completed $20 million worth of repairs and modifications to the system that feeds coal into the boiler. That's the system that malfunctioned and caused two explosions during test runs over the past couple of years. Borgeson says the problem appears to be fixed.
We feel fairly confident that we think we finally have it right.
He says the power plant and all its many subsystems also are running well.
It really operates extremely well. It runs very smooth. If they want to set it at 45 megawatts, it goes to 45. If they move it up to 50, it just every minute goes up half a megawatt like clockwork.
Coal is the cheapest fuel available for generating electricity, so Borgeson says Healy 2 will enable Golden Valley to cut operating costs by reducing use of its diesel and oil-fired generators. He says ratepayers should see those cost savings reflected in their bills as of December 1st.
It doesn't move the needle very much one way or the other, but as the cost of power drops like that, they might see a $5 to $10 change on their monthly bill.
The coal feeder system problems were the latest of many malfunctions at the power plant, which was completed in 1997 at a cost of $300 million in mainly federal and state funding. The plant began operation in 1998, but it failed to run dependably and economically, so it was mothballed in 2000. 13 years later, Golden Valley bought it for $44 million in a deal with the Alaska Industrial Development Investment and Export Authority. That's part of the $175 million total that Golden Valley has spent on upgrades at the plant, including systems to reduce emissions. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. And by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com. The Trust Fund Land Office annual fall sale is in full swing across Alaska. Revenue generated by the Trust Land Office helps fund local programs for local people. View parcels and learn more at alaskamentalhealthtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
Three Alaska Native tribal organizations have won nearly $3 million in federal housing grants to improve living conditions in more than 100 homes. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development announced the Tribal Healthy Homes Production Grants last week in Juneau. The recipients hope to use the money for home repairs, education, and to deal with mold and mildew issues. The Organized Village of Cake and the Tlingit Haida Regional Housing Authority each received $1 million. The Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium also won almost $870,000. Housing Authority Executive Director Joyce Niven says the organizations will work together and with partners to improve living conditions in their regions.
We all have different skill sets that we'll need to use to execute the grant because it's healthy homes. It's not just going in and repairing homes. It's educating people about managing their homes in a healthy manner.
One problem, she says, they frequently deal with in Southeast is mold and mildew. With the area's wet climate, respiratory issues can result from poor ventilation in people's homes. Niven says the Healthy Homes grant funding will help the organizations address those problems more thoroughly.
When we're in the homes, there's often so much work that needs to be done that we have to set priorities and figure out what's the most critical thing to get fixed. And these funds will help us not have to set so many priorities and maybe get the entire home fixed.
The Healthy Homes grants are the first of their kind. HUD awarded $12 million in total to 13 tribal organizations across the country. Niven says she and her staff will start work on an implementation plan due back to the federal government in 90 days. In many parts of Alaska, it's not uncommon to see a black bear lumbering through a neighborhood, especially in the summer or fall. The animals are crafty at getting into trash if it's not secured. But this summer, it seems like more bears have been spotted around Juneau scavenging for food, and scientists think they know why. Elizabeth Jenkins from Alaska's Energy Desk stopped by a house that's been documenting all the action.
Melissa Griffiths used to have an outdoor camera for security, but after moving to her home on Douglas Island, her motivation for wanting round-the-clock surveillance changed.
When we moved here, we decided that we would make it a nature cam, and it's been very effective. This year, we've seen a lot of bear activity, some porcupines, some deer.
She lives in a subdivision on a hillside. Her backyard leads into a huge expanse of forest. And this has become the scene of a familiar visitor.
Bear with me while I pull up this video.
Griffiths pulls out her cell phone to show me footage of a chubby black bear.
He comes down to the left of the playhouse in search of trash.
This isn't speculative. The bear reappears later in the video carrying something in its mouth. What appears to be a small plastic bag of garbage.
Yeah.
It's just, he's like carrying a bag like he's taking his groceries home or something.
Yeah, it's not the first time it's happened.
Griffiths emphatically states this is not her trash. She reckons it's from somewhere else in the neighborhood. Still, she's had to clean the mess up on several occasions. Her partner even broke two wooden spoons banging on a pan trying to scare the bears away. So Griffiths wanted to get the word out on securing garbage.
For the Douglas Island Block Party, I got this wild idea that I should make a trash bear cake.
The red velvet cake was shaped like a bear sitting on top of a dumpster. There was even little replicas of Rainier beer cans made out of fondant strewn about. Griffiths doesn't remember catching any bears on the camera last summer, but this year she spotted them in the yard at least 20 times. And she reported the uptick to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Carl Koch is one of the management biologists who reviews that information.
Could be anything from I saw a bear walking down the street to there's a bear ripping into my garbage or my chickens or my garage.
Last year, Fish and Game received roughly 470 calls about bear activity. By the end of August of this year, the department had already fielded more than 600.
This is the busiest year that I'm aware of since I've worked here.
But how unusual is all of this bear activity? Every summer, it seems like there's a story of a city bear in trouble. A bear walks into a bar, a bear gets a mayonnaise jar stuck on its head, a bear falls through a skylight onto a child's birthday party. All of that actually happened. But this year seems to be different. For starters, Koch says biologists think more cubs may have been born in the spring due to the mild winter. So there are possibly more bears and less natural food.
A lot of the fish runs were poor. And also, anecdotally, and from what I've seen myself out in the woods, it seems like the berry run is low this year.
Bears typically eat salmon to fatten up for hibernation. Dave Harris, a biologist with Fish and Game, says pink salmon will return to any little trickle. But they're on a two-year life cycle.
We're in a situation where our even-year pink salmon runs have become very depressed.
Harris says low pink returns are happening north of Petersburg up through the Inside Passage. The last even year, 2016, was declared by Governor Bill Walker as a fisheries disaster. This year, commercial fleets in southeast Alaska have reported catching half of that.
This is about the worst I've seen.
Harris says fisheries biologists aren't entirely sure what's happening. One study points to even-year pink salmon being less genetically adaptable to changing ocean conditions, like warmer water, than the salmon that spawn in odd years. On his survey flights, Harris has noticed more bears clustering around streams, almost like they're competing.
There's just a lot less food now available in this poor return of pink salmon for the bears, and so they're looking for other things.
And sometimes those other things take on the form of this stinky garbage sitting out on the curb. Next year, biologists predict odd-year pink salmon returns will be good. But in the meantime, the bear sightings could ramp up as they make that final push to find enough food before winter. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Jacob Resnick, Adeline Baxter, Elizabeth Jenkins and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Ravenna Koenig and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, and Anna Rose MacArthur and Teresa Katsarilis in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Did you know there's no safe amount of alcohol to drink while pregnant? But why should this matter if you're not pregnant or not trying to be? Because nearly half of all pregnancies are unplanned. Many women don't know they're pregnant right away. You could get pregnant and expose your baby to alcohol even before you know you're pregnant. If you're having unprotected sex, don't drink. Learn how FASDs impact everyone, even you, at letstalkfasdak.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.